Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 1st, 2013. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, the case for wild pollinators, a look inside cyber warfare, and the Earth's radiation belt.
We have this marvelous cosmic particle accelerator in Earth's backyard operating just a few thousand miles above our heads.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Earth's magnetic umbrella, created by the dynamo at the core of the planet, has protected us from powerful assaults by fast-moving particles for millions of years. Our protective cloak captures particles coming in as cosmic rays or spewing forth from the sun and runs them in a racetrack around the planet's middle. These Van Allen belts were first discovered in the 1950s, but a pair of probes loaded with high-tech sensors that launched this past September has already shown us how much we don't know about these radiant rings. I spoke with Daniel Baker about his group's surprising findings from his office in Colorado.
Well, our science paper is about the very high-energy particles that are confined in space within the extended magnetic field region surrounding our planet. Since their discovery some 55 years ago, the textbooks have told us that there are two distinct Van Allen belts. We have believed that a relatively stable inner zone and a highly dynamic outer zone separated from each other by a gap region called the slot, as virtually devoid of high-energy particles, exists. What we found, literally beginning just a couple of days after launch of new NASA dual satellite missions called the Radiation Belt Storm Probes, is there can be three remarkably distinct Van Allen belts with two very clearly defined slot regions. This has never really been clearly seen before or reported in the literature, and it suggests that the first scientific discovery of the space age needs to be thoroughly revisited, both theoretically and observationally.
Great. Well, so you mentioned this is the first finding of the space age. That's because we've known about the Van Allen belts for quite a while. Can you tell us a little bit about their composition and where these particles come from?
The long-term observations have suggested that, indeed, there are two Van Allen belts. The inner belt is a relatively stable region over months, years, maybe even centuries, comprised dominantly of very high-energy, positively charged particles, mostly protons, that are probably produced by cosmic rays interacting with the Earth's atmosphere. The outer Van Allen zone is thought to be comprised of very high-energy electrons, and that these are dominated by and are changed dramatically in their intensities by interaction with the solar wind, the hot gases flowing out from the sun.
They're belts, but they're actually donuts. One is closer to the Earth and one is further, or one is enclosed inside of the other?
Yes, there are two donuts or toruses that surround the Earth, and they are really nested as one goes out from the Earth. So the inner zone extends from a few hundred kilometers above the Earth's surface out to a few thousand kilometers, and the outermost belt then outside the gap or slot region extends from perhaps a few thousand kilometers out to perhaps 30,000 kilometers away from the Earth. So you should envision sort of two donuts that are placed away from the Earth.
Like two hula hoops, one
smaller?
Like
two hula hoops, but probably thicker, more
yeah.
Torus-like, yeah.
Okay, great. And with respect to the poles of the planet and are moving around the sun, how are they positioned with respect to that plane?
They are really confined sort of toward the magnetic equatorial plane or the Earth's equatorial plane. So if we use the hula hoop analogy, the Earth is the body here and the toruses are arrayed around the equator of the Earth.
And so you mentioned the magnetic charge of the Earth. How does that relate to the Van Allen belts?
Well, the magnetic field that emanates from the Earth's core is really the mechanism by which these particles are trapped. They're confined due to being charged particles. They're confined and spin around the Earth's magnetic field lines, and so they're trapped in a magnetic bottle, and the Earth's magnetic field really forms that bottle that confines these particles and keeps them there for long periods of time.
Okay. Well, so can you give us an overview of the Van Allen probes or the radiation belt storm probes? What are they doing and where are they positioned?
Yes, the idea was to launch very well-instrumented spacecraft into space to be able to revisit and to better understand the radiation regions around the Earth. This is important both scientifically and because this radiation affects so many of the satellites that now operate in space. And so the idea was to have very complete measurements from low to very high energy particles on each of the spacecraft, to have also measurements of magnetic fields locally, electric fields, and the waves that may cause changes in the particle distributions, and to have two of these spacecraft sort of almost in the same orbit, but a little bit separated from each other. And so they were supposed to fly in highly elliptical orbits near this magnetic equatorial plane where the radiation belts are most intense, extending from about 1,200 kilometers above the Earth's surface and extending out to about 30,000 kilometers altitude. And by having two of the spacecraft, we could really help to separate spatial from temporal variability.
Mm-hmm. So they're elliptical, so they're passing through the belts and also circling at the same time. So they're
That's kind of making cross sections of these belts.
That's
right. They're really cutting through all of these different regions, extending from the inner belt that I talked about, mm-hmm. cutting through that, and then cutting through the gap region, the slot region, and then making complete sweeps out through the outer Van Allen zone as well.
Great. And you talk about the foot and the throat in your paper. What do those terms mean here?
Yes, the foot of the magnetic field line, you might think of magnetic field lines as emanating right from the core of the Earth and extending out and then looping back. And you might think, for example, in high school or grade school even, where you looked at a bar magnet and you put that under a piece of paper and you looked at the iron filings as they distributed themselves along the magnetic field lines. Well, that's sort of in cross-section what we really see coming from the Earth's core. And so the foot of the field line is where those magnetic field lines extend down and sort of touch the Earth's atmosphere. The throat that we're talking about is really being in the throat of this cosmic accelerator. We have this marvelous cosmic particle accelerator in Earth's backyard operating just a few thousand miles above our heads. The idea of the radiation belt storm probes was to be able to fly through right where the action is in that cosmic accelerator, then be able to study what is it that causes the particles to be accelerated to very high energies, and what is it also that causes them to be lost from the system?
Well, so within a few days of launch, the Van Allen probes picked up something quite unexpected. Can you give us some more detail about this third storage ring?
Yes, it's really quite fascinating. We were supposed to turn on our instrument about 34 days after launch as part of the commissioning sequence. In fact, we needed to turn on our instrument as quickly as possible. We did that about 2 or 3 days after the launch of the mission. And indeed, about 2 days after we turned on, we saw that a part of the outer Van Allen zone was ripped away, and what was left was a limited torus, what I call the storage ring, of extremely high-energy particles. These extended clearly from about 2 million electron volts to probably over 10 million electron volts, very high-energy electrons, that just stayed there and stayed there and stayed there. They stayed there so persistently that my first worry was that there was something wrong with our instrument, that this couldn't possibly be true. We'd never seen this reported before. The textbooks told us not to look for anything like that.
Right.
And what we saw then was this sort of new torus stayed there solidly for several weeks, even as the more outer part of the radiation regions around the Earth were changing all over the place, and the inner zone also was staying pretty much as we'd expected. And so what we saw, instead of the expected two Van Allen belt structure, we saw three very clear, distinct belts separated on either side by a slot region.
Well, so this third ring actually did go away. So what do we know about what caused it to form and what actually caused it to dissipate?
Yes, it's fascinating that after seeing this so rock solidly for 4 weeks, thinking it might be there forever, along came a very powerful shockwave produced at the sun, came propagating out, encountered the Earth's vicinity, and that shockwave virtually annihilated the entire outer Van Allen zone, just like a knife edge, just cut everything off. And so after seeing this very stable situation for over 4 weeks, we then suddenly saw a complete change of state of the system, and we haven't really seen it recur since that time.
So what is this observation of a third ring, besides it being a big surprise, what does it tell us about the dynamics of the Earth's radiation belt and space weather?
Well, I think it's really telling us that what we thought we understood about how the Van Allen belts form, what it is that leads to the expected structure, really needs to be more deeply understood. We need to understand more about how particles can be accelerated to these high energies, but also to understand more how particles can remain almost immune to the external forcing of the solar wind changes for such extended periods of time. And so it's teaching us a lot that's new about how this remarkable accelerator storage system that I was talking to you about before. And to me, it really says that if we can measure things in new ways with better energy resolution, with better temporal resolution, better spatial resolution, especially extending up to higher energies, we can open essentially a new window on our local astrophysical universe here.
And to bring it down to ground level, to the Earth's surface, what kind of effects can we see here on the planet when the Van Allen belts change?
Well, these are things that are quite subtle, of course, for everyday human experience. It really hasn't been until we had a wealth of technological systems that respond to these high energy particles and highly disturbed solar conditions. If you think back 100 plus years ago, we had virtually no technologies that were really susceptible or would even have a sense
right.
of the changing sun and the changing radiation environment. As the telegraph and other technologies came on, we started to see more effects. Now we've surrounded ourselves in a cyber-electric cocoon that is susceptible to all of these kinds of changes, not only in the solar forcing, but also in the radiation regions around the Earth. Satellites are one example of this, but as the particles from the Van Allen belts are precipitated, we would call it, dumped into the Earth's atmosphere, this can change the composition, the nature of some of the middle atmospheric chemistry properties. It can also be associated with the kinds of things that lead to large-scale changes in the currents that flow in the Earth's ionosphere. These can couple into our power grids and other things. And so the changes in the Van Allen belts are one key part of the changing system we call the space weather effects. And these are things that are increasingly prominent, increasingly harmful to human technologies.
Fascinating. Daniel Baker, thanks so much for talking with me.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Daniel Baker and colleagues write about early results from the Van Allen probes online at www.scienceexpress.org.
Hey everyone, this week's show is sponsored by Audible.com, and they're offering a special deal to Science Podcast listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And as usual, we're giving a few recommendations of our own. I opted for an audiobook rendition of The Canon, a whirligig tour of the beautiful basics of science by Natalie Angier. She's the queen of word choice, in my opinion, and really enchants the reader into the nitty-gritty details of scientific discoveries. Okay, Carrie, what do you have?
Well, Sarah, I really enjoyed Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, The Story of Success. I think it really reveals a lot about how our societies preferentially propel people, some people, to higher achievement than others.
Well, so podcast listeners, check out these books and more from Audible. And don't forget to get your free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag.
Pollination isn't just important for the success of flowering plants and backyard gardens. It plays a critical role in the growth and abundance of agricultural crops. For this reason, it is a standard practice for many farmers to place honeybee hives amongst their crops. But honeybees aren't the only pollinators out there. And a recent study also says they may not be the most effective. Luca Scarabaldi spoke with me about the role of wild pollinators in agriculture and began by telling me a little bit about his research interests.
I'm an engineer agronomist, and I focus on plant-insect interactions. And on insects, I focus on those that eat pollen or nectar from flowers, and these are called pollinators. But I also focus on insects that eat, for example, the leaves of plants, and these are called herbivores. My research focused mostly on crops and agricultural production, but I also study insects and forests in Patagonia and how climate change can impact these plant-insect interactions. Our study is about crop pollination, and we found that wild insects were very important for crops to set the fruit and seed that we harvest for eating or for different agricultural products. We also found that the service that these wild insects provide cannot be replaced by honeybees. And of course, the honeybees provide some pollination, but even in places with a lot of honeybees, wild insects enhance crop fruit or seed set. And this has important implications for agricultural management and agricultural policies, and particularly on, of course, pollination management.
Right. And of course, when we think of pollinating, we tend to think of bees. But here you are talking about other insects, these wild pollinators. What are some of the wild pollinators that you studied here?
The most important wild insects are also bees. We know about 20,000 species of bees, but there are also important pollinators that are flies or butterflies and beetles, and this can be very important for particular crops. Also, bats and birds can be important for some crops.
And then before we, you know, dig into your study, generally, what are the benefits of pollination, particularly from the perspective of humans and agriculture?
Well, the amount of seeds or fruit that we harvest from an agricultural plot is limited or constrained by multiple factors like water, nutrients, pesticides, etc. And these crops can also be limited by pollen. The flowers need pollen to set seeds or fruits, mm-hmm. and these wild insects and also the honeybees help in the transfer of pollen from one flower to the other flower. So they reduce pollen limitation, and not only the quantity of pollen limitation, but also the quality of pollen they deposit is important. So by reducing the constraint of pollen limitation, they increase agricultural production.
So this study came about because some wild insect species appear to be declining. What is causing this decline of species in some agricultural settings?
Well, it's highly debated, but it seems that one of the most important causes are land use changes. So we have these huge monocultures that they can provide some resources for pollinators because crops also have flowers, and these flowers are resources. But the flowers are during a very limited period over the year, and the pollinators need to live all year round. And also the high use of chemicals can compromise pollinators in addition to the soil planting, because many pollinators nest in soil. Also other pollinators nest in tree trunks, so the absence of nesting sites can also compromise pollinator diversity and pollinator abundance in agricultural landscape. Also, species invasions in some places like Patagonia can compromise the diversity of the native fauna.
So let's talk about your study a little bit more then. So this is a study of the role of wild insects in pollination and a comparison of them with honeybees. What were your hypotheses and predictions going into this study, and what did you find?
Well, the current paradigm is that wild insects provide some pollination and they can be good pollinators, but most of the people think that this service that wild insects provide to agriculture can be replaced by adding a lot of hives of the honeybees mm-hmm. to the crops. So the current ideas were that this was mostly a problem of conservation and not so much of agricultural production.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not clear also what were the impacts of the loss of some species of wild insects from agricultural landscapes. So we found that in landscapes with lower diversity and lower abundance of wild insects, the crops set less seeds and less fruit. And this was true even in fields with a lot of honeybees, so that honeybees could not replace the amount of pollen and the quality of pollen that wild insects deposit, no matter how many honeybees, because we sample very widespread situations from field sites with not so many honeybees, but other field sites with plenty of honeybees that they were put exclusively for pollination, like almonds in California.
Interesting. So your findings show that wild pollinators are not only extremely important, but in some instances they actually play a greater role than honeybees in pollinating.
Well, they are more efficient and they are needed as honeybees. So we cannot base all of our agricultural management, especially pollination management, in only one species. This is highly risky. As we know, there have been many diseases on honeybees. And also, it's not the best strategy in terms of efficiency and in terms of maximizing production per area.
And so you advocate for actually a diversity of insects that are pollinating instead of just choosing one over another.
Exactly, exactly. We need more sustainable practices, more diverse landscapes that can produce a lot of food, also in the short but in the long term. It is important not to misunderstand our message that we are not against honeybees, but we do find that the current paradigm is not correct, because honeybees cannot replace wild insects and you need both. Honeybees are not enough, but they do provide a useful service. Mm-hmm. So both are important to produce food or agricultural products across time. For this sustainability, the diversity of different pollinator insects is very important.
So how do you think that this research, these findings, can make it into the field? You know, how can these practices that you're recommending here actually be adopted in an agricultural setting?
Well, it is important for agricultural management and to design more sustainable landscapes, probably with governmental incentives. And so we need more heterogeneous landscapes, not only huge monocultures that are very productive, we know that, but they are not very sustainable over time. Also, these heterogeneous landscapes will not only benefit pollinators, but they will benefit also other ecosystem services. We need to rotate more crops, and we can also make some specific measures to enhance pollinators, like adding flower or nesting resources and use pesticides not during the flowering period, for example, and those kind of things.
Great. Well, Lucas Garibaldi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lucas Garibaldi and colleagues discussed the roles of honeybees and wild pollinators online this week. You can find their report, a related report on 120 years of plant-pollinator interactions, and a perspective on the global threat to food production presented by pollinator losses at www.scienceexpress.org.
A science paper in this week's issue by Jane Danska and colleagues was featured on the Science Signaling podcast on February 19th. Danska spoke with Annalisa Van Hook about an interaction between the gut microbiota and sex hormones that influences the development of type 1 diabetes in mice.
The female recipients of male-sourced microbiota displayed significantly higher levels of testosterone than female recipients of female-sourced microbes.
Did they also have a decreased risk for developing type 1 diabetes?
Dramatically decreased. So they went from a frequency of 85% disease to 25% disease. It was quite striking.
You can listen to the whole segment in the February 19th issue of Science Signaling, and you can find the report by Danska and colleagues in this week's Science.
In a policy podcast this week, Meghna Sachdev interviews Science's editor-in-chief Bruce Alberts about the 150th anniversary of the National Academy of Sciences. And in the podcast, Alberts reflects on his tenure as president of the Academy from 1993 to 2005. You can find the podcast on the Science site or download it from iTunes anytime after Monday, March 4th.
After a private security firm released a report describing more than 100 hacking incidents originating in China, many U.S. companies have come forward to testify to their own data losses. Richard Stone, international news editor for Science, looked for the source of these intrusions in Chinese engineering circles. He spoke with me about tracking down sources and weighing the seriousness of these attacks in terms of national security.
There's been a lot of interest lately because of the report from Mandiant, the security firm based in the United States that investigated allegations into hacking by China. And the report came out last week. It was pretty startling in its conclusion, the sweeping cyber espionage that it reported.
And you've actually been following this story for quite a while. Way back in 2010, you were looking at this in China.
Well, it started out with Google, and they pulled out of mainland China in 2010 after uncovering pretty sophisticated attack targeting Gmail accounts of human rights activists. I'm especially fascinated by how nations have so effectively extended the cloak and dagger world of industrial espionage into cyberspace. And I think that there have been so many cases of companies coming forward with evidence of hacking. The computer security experts say that for every victim that comes forward, there are many that choose to remain silent.
Besides its history with Google, China also has a policy of policing its own internet or the access of its citizens to the internet. How does that fit together with the cyber attacks that people think are originating from China?
Well, they really go hand in hand. In the past couple of years, the number of reports from the U.S. government and think tanks have detailed this repression and raised allegations that China has engaged in cyber espionage on a grand scale. As analysts say, the activity, broadly speaking, is carried out by staff of the People's Liberation Army or by hacker groups sanctioned by the PLA.
And the PLA, is that actually the army of the People's Republic of China?
That's right. It is the Chinese military.
Okay. So you actually had the opportunity to speak to someone who works in China with the PLA in cyber defense. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Wasn't easy to get to this person, I have to say. It's a super sensitive topic in China. But I just gathered information from open sources as best as I could and finally got a break when a trusted contact referred me to this scientist with the surname Liu. Now, Liu refused to give his first name, but he revealed a lot of detail about the nature of his work for a PLA cyber defense office. When I met him in Xi'an, he was nervous, but he emphasized that he had been instructed to speak with me to convey the message that the military cyber activities were purely defensive.
Mm-hmm.
The same message was reiterated last week after the Mandiant report by spokespersons for China's foreign ministry and for the PLA.
But that's not what the report showed. The report showed that there was a little bit more than defense going on here.
It certainly seems that's not the case. The Mandiant report last week was pretty damning in detailing these attacks against 141 organizations, including 115 in the United States. Mandiant traced these attacks to a neighborhood in Shanghai, the location of a PLA bureau called Unit 61398. And that Western analysts alleged to be one of the PLA's chief cyber espionage units. So Mandiant documented that the hackers in Shanghai had stolen hundreds of terabytes of data, and that their favorite targets were firms specializing in information technology and in aerospace, you know, critical areas for the U.S. industry.
So let's talk a little bit more about what's actually going on back in China. You talked to people in academia and you looked at the academic output of cyber research from China. Can you talk about that some?
Over the past 5 years, China's National Administration for the Protection of State Secrets has established secrecy academies at 10 universities, and where computer science students are trained for sensitive jobs in Chinese government agencies. documents, and there's a big paper trail, show that standard science grant programs in China support a wealth of information engineering and cyber defense projects. And there are reports in the open literature where Chinese scientists publish on the injection of Trojan horses into the Windows platform, how to mount an effective attack on the U.S. power grid. So these are really interesting papers when you look at them. You wonder about the intent behind them, whether it's to reveal weaknesses.
So where are these kind of works being published?
The vast majority that I've come across are published in Chinese journals, mm-hmm. often in Chinese language. So it's very hard to gauge the intention of the authors. Of course, it could certainly go both ways. I mean, right. Certainly they are talented to be able to articulate these problems, but how this information is used, you know, that's the question right now that is weighing pretty heavily on people's minds.
So do you expect to see the opposite situation where, you know, we know that there was Stuxnet, which was used to attack Iran centrifuges, but no one's really claiming ownership and no one has published anything about the development of that officially?
Well, that gets into another point about the development of actual cyber weapons. Mm-hmm. And certainly the U.S. and Israel is credited with having developed the most successful cyber weapon so far, which is Stuxnet. And I can talk a little bit,
That'd be great.
About that, too. Yeah. A Stuxnet is a computer worm that was designed to damage the centrifuges that Iran is using to enrich uranium. Very sophisticated programming, and how it was managed to be inserted into the code of these machines suggests a very sophisticated operation. Analysts have credited the U.S. and Israel for developing Stuxnet, mm-hmm. and the U.S. has not acknowledged the author or co-author of this program, mm-hmm. but officials in the U.S. government have certainly indicated that they are quite proud of how well it worked.
Open secret.
Open secret, exactly.
Yeah. So in the U.S., what kinds of measures are actually being taken to prevent cyber intrusions?
All the effort going on is massive. In his State of the Union speech, President Obama declared that unidentified enemies are seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. He didn't mention China specifically. Mm-hmm. Clearly, this triggers a lot of activity in the U.S. government to try to prepare. And shortly after his speech, the U.S. Department of Energy announced $20 million in funding for the development of technologies to strengthen cybersecurity of delivery systems for electricity, oil, and gas. $20 million, I mean, that is not a big sum of money. If you want to know where a lot of the real action is, you have to go to the Pentagon. The Pentagon has a budget of about $3 billion a year to spend on cybersecurity. A few years ago, the Pentagon established U.S. Cyber Command in Fort Meade, Maryland, to conduct what it calls full-spectrum military cyberspace operations. Bear in mind, you know, that, as I mentioned earlier, Stuxnet is the most successful cyber weapon to date, and it's considered to be a U.S. or joint U.S.-Israeli creation.
So there's some activity for defending what we have, what we need to secure, and then there's also perhaps some offensive work going on in the Pentagon. So kind of looking at the big picture here, some of this is industrial espionage, and some of it could be considered closer to threats to security. When you talk about the energy grid, you talk about air traffic control, there's kind of an implicit threat to activities in the United States. But how serious is this threat? What are people saying in the security community about that?
People in the know who have access to, you know, classified information certainly are taking it deadly seriously. Jonathan Evans, the head of Great Britain's MI5 counterintelligence agency, has professed to be astonished by the level of cyber espionage going on worldwide. He calls industrial-scale processes involving many thousands of people lying behind both state-sponsored cyber espionage and organized cyber crime. A State Department official told me, though, last week that there's still debate going on in the U.S. government about whether China's cyber espionage activities truly have reached a level where they constitute a national security threat. That calculus changes when considering the specter of a cyber attack if a conflict involving the United States were to break out. Now, that might be alarmist, But cyber warfare is a contingency that countries must prepare for. As I learned reporting the story, they better hope that China's a friend and not a foe.
Well, Richard Stone, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Richard Stone is the international news editor for Science. He writes about cybersecurity in this week's issue. Finally today, Carrie Klein here, and with me I've got online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the past week's stories from our online daily news site. So Dave, in our first story, we've got an underwater puzzle.
This first story is about some potentially hidden continents, or at least very large landmasses that may exist on Earth. We're not exactly talking Atlantis here, but maybe something not as far-fetched. This has to do with the Indian Ocean, and it turns out that some of the islands in the ocean may actually lie on top of the remains of an ancient continent that was pulled apart by plate tectonics between 50 million and 100 million years ago.
So what tipped scientists off that something like this may even be possible?
Well, Carrie, it turns out that there's a lot of places in the Indian Ocean where Earth's gravity is kind of unusual. Places like Madagascar, the Seychelles, they have slightly stronger gravitational field than is expected. And one thing that might explain it is abnormally thick crust. Hmm. If that's the case, it could be the crust is actually about 25 kilometers thick, which would cause it to resemble continental crust, which is compared to about the 5 to 10 kilometers of oceanic crust elsewhere. So that would be really unusual. However, thickness alone doesn't prove that crust is continental and that you would actually have maybe a hidden continent.
Right.
In this part of the world. So they actually, the researchers in this study looked for some other lines of evidence. They reconstructed the movements of the tectonic plates to determine where and how these potential fragments of undersea crust were once connected to the continents. They were able to show that until about 90 million years ago, these places with this really sort of unexpectedly high gravity would have all been attached to India, which is really interesting. And the researchers actually looked for some chemical evidence, and they took sand samples from several beaches in Mauritius, which is an African island located about 1,700 kilometers southeast of the Seychelles. The surface rock of Mauritius is made from volcanic oceanic crust or basalt, but its beach sands contain not just fragments of this eroded lava, but also zircons, which is a mineral associated with continental crust.
But aren't there multiple ways for these zircons to have gotten to these beaches?
That's right. But it turns out that the zircons that they found from Mauritius were hundreds or even thousands of millions of years old. And the island's oceanic crust was less than 10 million years old, which means that these are really coming from a very sort of different place.
And so where would they, how could they have ended up on these beaches then?
Well, Carrie, the idea is that the zircons would have existed in the pre-existing continental crust, but when then the magma that formed Mauritius broke through this crust, it may have carried some of these zircons with them, and they would have become incorporated into the basalt lava that the researchers analyzed.
How cool. I wonder if there could be any more evidence for this out there.
Well, it actually turns out that the Indian Ocean actually could be littered with continental fragments, like the fragments that the researchers are postulating about here. So there actually might be a lot more evidence popping up of this hidden land beneath the waves.
Great. And next up, we've got some news for those of us who are plagued with acne.
Right. Not one of my favorite topics, at least when I was growing up. But it turns out 80% of Americans and a large percentage of other people around the world have acne, especially when they're going through puberty, when they're growing up. And it's recently been speculated that acne is caused by a bacterium or bacteria in the skin. There's one particular bacterium called Propionibacterium acnes, appropriately enough, which seems to be associated with acne, although researchers aren't exactly sure how it causes acne.
Mm-hmm. So here they've made a little bit more of a connection. Tell me about this new study.
Well, what they did was these researchers took 101 people, 49 of whom had acne and 52 which had very normal sort of clean skin, and they swabbed their faces and they examined all the bacterial DNA that they could find. And not surprisingly, they were finding a lot of this Propionibacterium acnes. But what was interesting is it wasn't just this one type of this particular type of bacteria. There's actually a lot of different subtypes of it. In fact, the researchers identified 66 different strains that they hadn't seen before. And they found that two of these strains, which they call RT4 and RT5, tended to be found predominantly in people with acne. But there was one strain called RT6, which was found almost exclusively in people with clear skin.
Interesting. So they found some bacteria tied very clearly to people with acne and some tied to people without.
Exactly.
So, of course, this brings up the question of cause versus association.
Right. And they think there's a causal effect here because they say this good strain, what they're calling this good strain of bacterium, contains genes known to fight off bacterial viruses and other potentially harmful microbes. So they suspect that it actually may be like, you know, the bacteria in our guts are not doing bad things, they're actually doing good things. They help us digest food. They may actually even be protecting us from diseases. Maybe very similar with bacteria on our face. Some of them may fight off other harmful microbes, which would otherwise cause acne.
So if true cause and effect were actually to be found here, could this ever lead to an actual therapeutic use for this knowledge?
Right, exactly. And the researchers are sort of making the analogy with probiotics. I don't know if we want to smear bacteria on our face, but you know, maybe we could find what it is about these bacteria that are having this protective effect, isolate the compound, and that could be turned into a drug or potentially a face cream or something like that. So acne may not be with us for good. Who knows?
Right. I'll keep my fingers crossed for the next generation of teenagers.
Right.
And in our final story today, instead of giving it an intro, I'd just kind of like to read the first sentence here. In the swamp of the blind, the frog with one eye surgically attached to its back is king. What does that mean, Dave?
Well, what it means is we're sort of dealing with Franken frogs here. And actually, not really Franken frogs, but Franken tadpoles. Researchers have taken eyeballs from tadpoles and surgically reattach them to different places on the animal's body, most notably places along their backs.
And why did they do that?
That is a great question. The reason why they did that is they're really trying to get at the roots of vision. What is it about the eyes that help us see? How do they connect? And actually, really beyond that, how do they transmit their visual information to the brain?
Hmm.
And what the researchers were hoping to do is figure out, you know, if we attach eyes to random places on these tadpoles' bodies, will it give us a sense of how this visual information is transmitted to the brain and how it affects behavior?
Right. Okay. So how did eyes transplanted around the body help tell us that information?
Well, what the researchers did was they put these tadpoles sort of in a petri dish. And if they moved to a red portion of the petri dish, they received a mild electric shock. And this was to sort of train them to avoid going to that area. And obviously, those who could see the red were going to avoid this area. And so once the researchers had these tadpoles trained, they made some of them blind. They let some of them keep their eyes, and others, they reattached the eyes to various places around the back. And as expected, those with intact eyes were pretty good at avoiding the red side of the petri dish. And about 40% of them did so. And none of the blind tadpoles were able to avoid the red side of the petri dish. Pretty obvious they couldn't see. But 10% of those with the transplanted eyes, with the eyes transplanted on the back, also avoided the red side of the petri dish, suggesting that some of them were somehow able to see this red side of the petri dish despite not having eyes where they should be, but having the eyes on their backs.
Physiologically, what do scientists think was actually going on in these 10% of blind tadpoles with reattached eyes?
Well, when they looked a little bit closer, they found that only those tadpoles whose transplanted eyes had formed connections with their spinal cords were able to learn to avoid the red side of the petri dish, which suggests that you can't just put an eye anywhere and expect it to work like an eye. It really has to connect to the rest of the nervous system. And indeed, the eyes that were just sort of attached to form connections with the guts or other parts of the body didn't serve any purpose.
Right. So is this knowledge eventually transferable in any way to humans?
Well, that's what the researchers hope. They're learning more about how eyes can be transplanted, how they form connections. And now that we know, you know, sort of some of the connections that are really critical to conferring vision, researchers say that we could have new ways to conduct eye transplants in humans, even ways to create bionic hands and other appendages that could potentially do some of the seeing for us.
Okay, and what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, we've got a story about how birdsong could shed light on the evolution of language in people.
Hmm.
Also a story about some of the earliest nude female figurines that humans created. These are figurines that are tens of thousands of years old. And what they may have been used for, what their purpose was. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a new science scandal happening in Russia. Also a story about this sequester happening in the United States. What are the impacts of the proposed massive budget cuts going to have to scientific researchers, to scientists and their careers? And along those lines, we've actually set up a page on the site where scientists, grad students can come and just sort of share their thoughts about the sequester. How is even the threat of sequester impacting their research, their ideas about future careers? So be sure to check that out on the site. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about the science of your dog's brain. What are we learning about canine cognition? And I actually will be moderating that one myself. Next week's Science Live is about open access. What is the latest in the open access publishing debate? You can log on and ask questions from a couple of world experts. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. And while you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the March 1st, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.